Two Jamaicans pulled ahead. Pipe unsheathed the .357. He paused momentarily to get a clear shot at the back of Brown's head. Brown turned. Pipe squeezed off two shots in quick succession. A bullet ripped through Brown's neck, and he collapsed. On the ground, Pipe shot twice more at his chest. Pipe turned to fire at Scandal, not wanting to leave witnesses, and let loose three shots, all he had left, but the Jamaican had disappeared into the bushes. So thick was the cover that he was gone within seconds. Pipe had been half-drunk and half-stoned, but the surge of adrenaline cleared his mind. Pipe knelt down and saw Brown's eyes rolling up into his head. He felt his pulse. Nothing. He bought two more six-packs and returned to his position outside 551, where he gulped them down. When he'd carried out his first shooting at 11, he didn't care if he hit his targets or not. Now he was killing to stay alive. The shooting was merely what was expected of him. The next morning, 911 flashed across the screen of his beeper. He raced up to Soundview. "The nigger you shot last night ain't dead," someone told him. "Get the fuck out," Pipe said. "I shot him in the head twice." Brown had crawled through the bushes and eventually emerged on Commonwealth Avenue, a small street lined with narrow three-story red brick houses. He lurched up the steps of number 46 and rang the bell. When the door opened, the startled homeowner saw a bloodied man with a disfigured face who struggled to stand, a gaping wound in the side of his neck. The man called the police. Brown was taken to Jacoby Hospital. Doctors found a bullet lodged under his left ear, which had damaged his hearing. The other round had passed through the left side of his neck and out the front of the right. The shots Pipe had fired to his chest had missed his vital organs. Pipe figured that Brown would not cooperate. But 6 weeks later, on September 1, 1995, Pipe was in a store at Cozy Corner around 6 p.m. when a carload of homicide cops drove by. They didn't stop, but he handed his Glock to the store owner's son for safekeeping. He bought a pack of Newports and walked outside, peeling off the cellophane and jamming a cigarette in his mouth as he fumbled for a lighter. He heard a gun cock behind him. Two uniformed cops slapped on handcuffs before marching him to the middle of the horseshoe. One went to get reinforcements, while a rookie cop covered him nervously, his gun drawn. Bear, Pipe's longtime protector, walked up with some young women who started screaming when they saw Pipe in handcuffs. "Mo, what's good?" said Bear, staring angrily at the police. "Be easy," said Pipe. "It's all good. They got nothing on me. I be out in no time." At the 43rd, Pipe was placed in a room for questioning. The police found $3,000 in his wallet. "Listen, we know who you are," a detective told him. "We've seen you since you were a kid selling crack, running around for drug dealers, and now here you are giving orders out there, a big shot." Pipe said he didn't know what they were talking about. The detective tried to convince him that they knew it was a hit paid for by Scandal. "Just tell us somebody paid you to do a hit, and we'll get you 5 years," said the detective. Pipe refused to rat, but made a mental note. The only way they would know that was from Scandal himself. The detectives pushed a wheelchair in. Brown sat in it, so heavily bandaged he looked like a mummy. "Yep, that's the nigga that shot me," he said. Pipe exploded. The man had violated the street code.
"You fucking cocksucker," screamed Pipe. "You're supposed to come back and retaliate. You ain't meant to tell. I should have fucking killed you. I didn't tell them when you robbed me. How you now tell on me?" He charged at Brown before the detectives could restrain him. Within a few weeks, Pipe found himself in Rikers Island with Pete. They were in opposite ends of the prison, Pipe in Mod 1, while Pete bided his time in C-73, an area reserved for the most troublesome inmates. Pipe arrived with $3,000 in cash and wearing a Rolex, which one of the guards tried to pocket when he checked his personal belongings. On the block, men sized Pipe up as an adolescent dealing with his first time on the island. Pete had put out the word that Pipe was to be taken care of, so they knew that he wasn't easy prey. And they saw the respect that the seasoned Soundview gangsters accorded him, particularly when Pipe produced a picture of himself with B-Love and Pete.
But while Pipe went into prison as East Coast gang royalty, he lay on his bunk on the first night, floundering in melancholy. He faced serious time, and now his mother would not be sitting in the visiting room to wait for him anymore. In Spofford, at 14, she had come to see him and said that she would never leave him no matter what happened. There was no girlfriend who cared for Pipe like that. They only came when he had money. Pipe stifled his sobs, folding his arms over his head and curling into a fetal position in the darkness. The next morning he steeled himself again. He was done with grieving. He tried to get ready for his first visit to the Bronx Criminal Court. He'd been charged with attempted murder in the second degree. The bullpen behind the courts was notoriously dangerous. Young men from warring factions all over New York found themselves confined in close proximity, and Pipe wouldn't have the protection of Sex Money Murder's name among kids from Brooklyn or Queens. Before being let off, he had taken the illegal razor he had been given when he arrived in Rikers, covered it in plastic, smeared the small package in Vaseline, and secreted it up inside his anal cavity. He kept an eye on men who robbed other defendants for their sneakers in the bullpen. It began when they asked others, "What size you wear?" If it was a match, some defendants would later arrive in court bleeding and shoeless. Pipe's lawyer, paid for by Pete, advised that it was better to take a plea than to go to trial. This would be his first felony as an adult, and the court might be more lenient if he admitted his guilt. Moreover, during his explosive confrontation with Brown at the 43rd Precinct, Pipe had all but admitted to shooting the man, and that evidence would now be used against him. B-Love and the others came to visit Pete and Pipe on alternating days so that they could courier messages from one to the other. B-Love told Pipe that Pete was angry. With Pipe gone, the crew had lost its top man in the street. Pipe took the scolding like a little brother and shrugged it off. Further, Pete told him to try to beat the charges at trial rather than taking a plea, as the lawyer had suggested. Retaliatory attacks were being carried out against the Jamaicans to warn them off testifying, although it hadn't seemed to make any difference. The next few days would be crucial. Pete was weighing a big decision for Sex Money Murder. He had grown close with one of New York's legendary gangsters, Omar O.G. Mack Portee, the godfather of the United Blood Nation, formed in 1993. Portee now ran the most powerful prison gang on the East Coast. He had grown up in the tenements at West 183rd Street and Davidson Avenue to the west of the Grand Concourse, raised by his grandmother. At 17, he helped carry out an armed robbery, among other crimes, and was sent to prison. Freed 2 years later, in 1990, he was sent to California by his mother, who thought he might find another path there. Instead, he learned that his relatives were deeply involved with the Miller Gangster Bloods, a powerful crew in south-central Los Angeles. Portee admired the Bloods' command structure and their rigorous adherence to the colors. When he returned to New York and his own gang, he told them he had permission, now disputed in gang circles, to convert them to a Blood set. They became the 1-8 Trey, the first Bloods in New York City. Portee was arrested for attempted murder in 1992 and sent back to Rikers Island. As an African American, he was victimized under the boot of the Latin Kings, who targeted blacks. The Latin Kings controlled every aspect of prison life, from the drug trade to recreation areas to the phones. Yellow bandanas were tied to the phones to indicate they were for kings only. Violators could be killed. Some of the guards were Latin Kings or associates. The black street crews were in complete disarray, fighting each other rather than consolidating against the kings. In July 1993, Portee reached out to black gang leaders, preaching the philosophy of the Black Panthers and urging them to unify. The first few inmates who agreed became the Nine Trey gangsters. Within days, more gangs joined, including the Valentine gangsters from the Bronx River Projects near Soundview, and a Brooklyn crew led by a savagely violent man named Leonard Deadeye McKenzie. O.G. Mack crowned himself first superior, or godfather, of an organization he called the United Blood Nation, the umbrella name for 14 sets of Bloods from all of New York's five boroughs. Mack later called his top lieutenants Original Gangsters, or O.G. for short. In Rikers, he drew up a constitution, a list of 31 blood rules and an orthodoxy for his new group. The first commandment stated, "In our organization, we will have no snitches." Anyone who snitched would become food, meaning that he would be killed by the Bloods, and those who balked at their duty would themselves become food. To kill a snitch would immediately give you status in the organization. To keep members under control, he formed the Bloody Bastards, whose role was to hurt or kill members who didn't carry out orders. OG Mac and OG Deadeye developed a mode of attack called the Buck 50, slashing someone's face with such viciousness it would require 150 stitches. The 28th commandment was to revere OG Mac. "In our organization, we will honor OG Mac, the godfather of the reborn United Blood Nation." The 29th was a command to multiply. "In our organization, we will breed with bloodettes to create blood drops." OG Mac's genius was to harness the fear that marked every disenfranchised kid's life in the street. Terror of death, jail, arrest, and then offer a quasi-military hierarchy and the chance to be lieutenants and then generals in a fully functioning, cohesive army, rising in rank from one-star general all the way to five-star. The Bloods took over cell blocks from the Latin kings by conducting all-out war, tearing off the yellow bandanas on the phones and replacing them with red ones. Authorities saw the Bloods' growing threat and dispersed them among various prisons to weaken their power base in Rikers. But this only served to spread the movement like a virus. New recruits had 31 days to learn the commandments, often written in code. As the authorities deciphered the codes, OG Mac changed them again, calling a new list death notices, and when those were cracked, he came up with the Dirty 100s. As the violence intensified, OG Mac became an invisible deity in the prison system, a gangster god with disciples to do his bidding. He let the streets know that he might not control every block on the outside, but on the inside, where every dealer could expect to spend some time, you entered his kingdom. If you didn't do the Bloods' bidding in the free world, then when you came to prison, you were a marked man. Within a few weeks of Pete's arrival, OG Mac was courting him to join the nation. He filled Pete's head with stories about black civil rights leaders and how, by joining, he could become more powerful than he ever imagined within the prison system. Pete wasn't convinced. Not only was he a boss already, but his deadly reputation on the street far outstripped OG Mac's. Why would he relinquish control to fall in behind OG Mac, taking rules from someone who was a lesser gangster to begin with? Pete refused. OG Mac returned 2 weeks later with a more tempting offer. He offered Pete and Sex Money Murder total autonomy within the United Blood Nation, the only crew to have such distinction. In prison, they would have protection and even more power, but on the street, Sex Money Murder was free to do what they had always done. They would answer to no one. And Pete would have the power to form subsets of Sex Money Murder. When B-Love and Stymie visited Pipe, they brought a question from Pete. Would Pipe endorse the transition to Bloods? Pipe had already beaten up a Blood who had interfered with his phone time, so he wasn't wholly impressed with their mettle. However, he said to tell Pete that Sex Money Murder had ascended under his leadership, and Pipe wasn't going to question his decision-making now. Deep down, Pipe knew that Pete was lonely. He didn't have his crew around him, the fraternal love, deference, and protection, and he was making decisions based on the aching solitude he was experiencing in Rikers. Pipe suspected Pete wasn't serious about the Bloods, that it was just a phase. But if Pete wanted the switch, Pipe would back him. Through a series of hearings in Bronx Criminal Court, Pipe learned that Natalie Brown was recovering and prepared to testify against him. Brown wasn't scared of Sex Money Murder without Pete Rolock on the street. The lawyer tried to work a deal with the district attorney, who offered leniency if Pipe pled guilty and waived his right to a grand jury indictment. Despite Pete's insistence that he should go to trial, Pipe had been told by his lawyer that Brown's testimony could result in 7 to 21 years behind bars. He caved, copping a plea. In September 1995, Pipe shuffled into Bronx Criminal Court, AP 6, for his sentencing. Sitting in the front of the public gallery was a well-dressed Jamaican woman, Natalie Brown's mother, and one or two relatives who looked at Pipe with loathing. His victim wasn't there. The judge asked Pipe to admit his guilt. "Yeah, I shot him in the head," said Pipe. "Did you shoot to kill him?" "Yeah, I was trying to kill him," said Pipe. "But he lived, and if he hadn't, I wouldn't be here." He was sentenced to 3 to 6 years. As he was led out of court, he shot a contemptuous smirk at Brown's mother and her family. On October 16, 1995, after a few weeks in Rikers, he was shipped to Ulster Correctional Facility. He was issued a green uniform, and a prison barber shaved off his cornrows to the nub. 2 weeks later, he was moved to Washington Correctional Facility, north of Albany. Without the stress of the street, Pipe got healthy again, lifting weights as the dull routine of prison life stretched the passage of time. About 6 months into his sentence, a young Blood Gang member approached him. "You Pipe?" he asked. Pipe warily said yes. The young man explained that he had a message from Pete. Pipe brightened. "You're 031, said the Blood. Pipe didn't understand. "You're second in command of sex money murder, right?" Pipe nodded. "Pete says he is first superior 030 and you are second superior 031. And then Pipe got it. These were Blood codes denoting rank. Pete had flipped sex money murder to a Blood set. O.G. Mac and Pete had completed a massive underworld merger, and they now were figureheads in an organization that wielded enormous power in prison and was taking over neighborhoods on the outside. If Pete wanted something done, he only had to reach out to any of the Blood sets up and down the East Coast. Sex money murder was now officially entered into O.G. Mac's Bible, the ledger that contained all the Blood sets and the corresponding ranks of members within them. In a rare breach of protocol, sex money murder had been accepted without having to prove themselves with acts of violence. Their name alone inspired fear. Pipe knew that the change would be immense. They'd become part of a small army, a national movement that controlled the prisons. But he also nursed serious doubts. Sex money murder had been highly lucrative, but he could see nothing about the Bloods that would increase SMM's profitability on the street. The Bloods deal would give them protection in prison, but it was a bonus Pipe felt they didn't need anyway. They were feared already. And the price of Pete's decision was that Pipe had to watch his back more than before. All the Blood feuds and their enemies were now his, too, thanks to Pete. Pipe suppressed his anger. All he wanted was to do his time quietly before getting back on the street to make money. Still, as the days wore on, his new position conferred a feeling of immeasurable power on the 19-year-old. As a sex-money-murder lieutenant, he was now the highest-ranking Blood in Washington Correctional Facility, leader of 150 gang members in the prison. In the streets, he controlled a few members of Sex Money Murder and the Projects. Inside, as an OG, he was revered by young men from Brooklyn to Harlem, from Rochester to Albany, many of whom he had never met, who would put their lives on the line for him without a second thought. Moreover, in a prison hierarchy that saw convicted murderers enjoying higher status than attempted shooters like himself, Pipe now controlled serious gangsters with many bodies to their names. As they marched single file to breakfast, Pipe led his fellow Bloods in a chant.
"Peace to the Almighty," he yelled like a Marine drill instructor. "Peace, Blood," answered 40 men in unison. "Up top," shouted Pipe. "Down low," they responded. "Red light, green light. Bang, bang."
The guards looked on impassively.
"Whose house?"
shouted Pipe.
"Blood house."
10. Nasty Boys. O'Malley arrived for work at Federal Plaza on February 21, 1995, and took a corner office on a lower floor. The detective from the Bronx found himself surrounded by Ivy League-educated prosecutors, many from wealthy families. On Friday nights, they ordered in Lorenzo's pizza and beer and sat in the seventh-floor conference room, trading stories about their first gun-collar cases, a rite of passage for new AUSAs, Assistant United States Attorneys. They were some of the most intelligent young men and women in America, and they wouldn't last 10 seconds in the Bronx projects alone, and they knew it. They looked to O'Malley for guidance and protection. O'Malley often acted as translator of gangster slang for the brand new federal prosecutors. He watched them taking notes and noticed that they stopped writing, puzzled, when a gangster said things like, "went for his gat," or "pulled the heat," both slang for guns, or "got rocked." O'Malley waited until they were on break, or sometimes asked them to step out if they were really confused, before he explained the terms out of earshot of the cooperators so that the prosecutors wouldn't look green in front of them. He made sure the AUSAs never exhibited indecision or a lack of comprehension. A few months after O'Malley's arrival in September 1995, Prosecutor Liz Glazer founded the Violent Gangs Unit at the Southern District, focusing on street and drug gangs. The FBI, long preoccupied with the mafia, had no division designated solely for street gangs, something many federal agents considered beneath them and mainly a local problem. Glazer's new section was a pioneering move for federal law enforcement. By 1995, New York City's gangs had evolved from the street crews of the late 1980s to become part of the framework of national gangs, a trend exemplified by the almighty Latin King Nation, which had its origins in Chicago. In New York, they were led by the motivational Luis Kingblood Felipe, who had turned victimized Hispanic inmates in a predominantly black prison population into the dominant prison gang before the war with the Bloods. But they had also begun to assume serious power on the streets. While in prison for shooting his girlfriend, Felipe wrote hundreds of coded letters decreeing that his followers, TOS, terminate on sight, anyone found to be a threat. One man had his hands and head cut off and his gang tattoos sliced from his body before his corpse was burned in a bathtub. O'Malley, chief investigator on the case, followed protocol by bringing in the FBI as the lead federal agency. He was impressed with their access to resources. Just to get started, they had a $20,000 account to pay informants. In his days with the NYPD, he had paid subjects $20 out of his own paycheck. The first order of business was breaking the Latin King's codes in letters. O'Malley used connections within New York State Corrections Intelligence to find cooperators in the prison system, whom he interviewed. They helped him crack the ciphers and, in turn, start to build a case against King Blood and his gang. O'Malley checked the weapons used in the killings and discovered that chapters of the Kings all over the five boroughs passed the same guns back and forth. He toured the precincts, getting homicide reports to check the murder weapons used, and was able to draw a huge ballistics chart showing how just a few guns were deployed in murders all over the city by gang members. This detail proved that the Kings could be classified as an enterprise, which meant that the case was eligible for RICO prosecution. Eventually, 51 Kings were indicted. O'Malley worked with a young prosecutor, Steve Cohen, who liked to recline on the sofa in his office in worn jeans, reading classics. The federal system is predicated on the idea that a federal prosecutor should never lose because the cards are entirely stacked in the government's favor. A prosecutor has huge power in deciding if charges should be brought and, crucially, who can plead and who can't, and who can be offered a deal. 95% of all criminal cases are resolved with pleas, and for those who lose at trial in the federal system, judges have little leeway in breaking away from sentencing guidelines. Cohen leveraged his near invincibility in court when he and O'Malley got Latin Kings to flip. It didn't take more than a few weeks for him to receive a call from a lawyer after they talked them into cooperating. "Welcome to Team America," Cohen said when one agreed to cooperate. Every time King Blood appeared in court, demonstrations took place outside, with gang members shouting, "Amor de Rey!" Their chants could be heard inside the U.S. Attorney's office. O'Malley spotted men with outstanding warrants and started to pick them off outside court. In time, the demonstrations stopped. Only King Blood went to trial, and he got life plus 45 years. O'Malley and Cohen had flipped the rest, who either pled guilty or cooperated. Without a squad and a partner who knew the streets, the work was lonely at first. O'Malley plotted a landscape of crime in the city and incubated cases with detectives who began to turn to him. The doctrine of the streets was entirely different from the logic of American jurisprudence. One young female prosecutor demanded to know why the owner of a bodega in the Bronx could not be subpoenaed to give evidence. When O'Malley resisted, saying he would be killed for testifying, she said, "We'll move him." O'Malley explained that the bodega was his livelihood and that he would lose it if he testified. Moreover, the next murder they would be adding to the indictment would be that of the store owner. O'Malley instructed the prosecutors to go to crime scenes, to get out of the office and see the communities where the crimes took place. He warned them not to react with shock when cooperators admitted their crimes. "Make like you've heard it before, okay?" A violent robber known as Chuck told a story of sending a pretty girl to knock on the door of a drug den and then bursting in with a gun when the door was opened. He said that he had made everyone in the apartment lie on the floor. Still, the dealer wouldn't give up his stash. "Normally we torture them, but I saw a baby," said Chuck, "so I put the baby in the microwave." The prosecutor blanched and then looked like he might faint. O'Malley used the story as a teaching moment. The NYPD got a boost from incoming Chief William Bratton, who had a strong mandate from Mayor Rudolph Giuliani to reduce crime. Cops were issued 9mm semi-automatic pistols and could choose between Glock, Sig Sauer, and Ruger instead of the old-fashioned Smith & Wesson 38 caliber revolvers. The three arms of the NYPD were merged, and as O'Malley saw it, crime-fighting gained a more serious focus with the broken windows approach. In 1995, the NYPD launched CopStat, the brainchild of a former transit patrolman, or cave cop, Jack Maple, known for wearing saddle shoes, three-piece suits, and a Homburg. Maple had created Charts of the Future, 55 feet of hand-drawn diagrams of crime hotspots for robbery squads to tackle. When felonies fell by 27%, CopStat was taken citywide. Between 1993 and 1995, New York City's annual homicides dropped from 1,946 to 1,170, a decrease many attributed to CopStat. Coupled with the success of CopStat, Bratton had also heard of the Fed's success in taking out street crews. He demanded that all commanders bring him RICO cases. One particular area of Hunts Point, identified after a CopStat meeting, offered an ideal place to build a case. Sergeant William Sean O'Toole, the commander of Bronx Homicide, offered to take Liz Glazer to Hunts Point. A sense of hopelessness pervaded the area. Vacant lots, spiderwebbed with cracks and weeds, and forbidding tenement buildings had proved impervious to law enforcement. On the hooker stroll, HIV-ravaged women, scarred from beatings by their pimps, offered sex for $20 and blowjobs for $10. They complained to arresting cops that crack addicts were offering sex for so little that their own prices had been forced down to rock bottom. Police rarely arrested them because they were afraid of coming into contact with HIV. Here, murder victims were laid out for hours before the police were called. Three drug crews fought for the turf. The Nasty Boys, the Benicas organization, and the Bryant Boys. They sold directly opposite each other, competing for customers. Bronx Homicide worked with a narcotics module in conducting undercover buys as they looked for a way to make arrests and stop the killing. Glazer was looking for a way to get gang members on federal charges. Under state law, gang members faced gun charges so small that they wouldn't even bother to return to court after they'd been charged and bailed. So she pioneered Trigger Lock, a federal gun charges program that mandated 4 years with no parole. Meanwhile, one of O'Malley's old partners at Bronx Homicide, Joe Marrero, flipped an enforcer for the leader of the Nasty Boys on Rikers Island, and a major RICO case ensued. In November 1995, 31 members of the Bryant Boys and the Nasty Boys were indicted. The arrests transformed the neighborhood. The murder rate in the 41st Precinct dropped 51% in the first 10 months following the arrests. O'Malley worked some of the proffer sessions. It generally took several meetings for someone to offer up information. During the Bryant boys' trials, O'Malley sat at the back of the courtroom watching a defense attorney grill one of his cooperators. "You met with the government 50 or 60 hours, right?" The gangster nodded. "And you told them everything, right? Told them all the crimes you'd ever done? And you pled guilty to all those, right?" The gangster gave an effusive yes for the last question. "Did you tell him about the time you raped your brother?" O'Malley heard his cooperator gasp. He'd been happy to admit murders to a female prosecutor, but not male rape. They still got the conviction, but O'Malley had learned something. From then on, he told his cooperators to admit any sexual aberrations to their lawyers before trial. O'Malley was gaining experience and adding layers to his work as an investigator. From 1993 to 1996, over 300 gangsters were charged and convicted of more than 250 homicides in the Southern District of New York. O'Malley garnered a reputation in the tight-knit criminal circles in the MCC. "I want to talk to O'Malley," became a familiar refrain as gangsters realized that making a deal was the only way out. Meanwhile, Detective Gil Lugo from Bronx Homicide had learned in interviews with some of the Nasty Boys about another crew who were even more deadly. They called themselves Sex Money Murder, and their leader hid the bodies of men he had killed. The information checked out, especially allegations of homicide and drug trafficking over state lines, which could make another RICO case. Lugo and O'Toole passed it to a former Bronx homicide detective they trusted who worked on the inside at the feds. O'Malley, intrigued to hear of an ultra-violent gang from his old neighborhood, began work. Act 3. Ultraviolence. The Fall of Sex Money Murder. Thus, he grew to manhood without the slightest conception of right and wrong, with an aversion to honest labor that amounted to actual loathing, and with a keen admiration for the man who was able to get much for nothing. Moreover, his only escape from the misery of his surroundings lay in excitement, and he could imagine no outlets for his turbulent spirit save sex and fighting. Herbert Asbury, The Gangs of New York, An Informal History of the Underworld, 1927. 1. The Fist. Shug, 22 years old, stepped outside the weathered brick walls of the Old Colony Correctional Center in October 1996. A Department of Corrections bus took him 30 miles north to Boston and then on to Springfield. As he rolled through the green folds of the Massachusetts countryside, he thought only of all the drug money he heard was now flowing through Soundview. Once back in the Bronx, he embraced Miss Julia, who looked him up and down with a weary welcome. "You stay your ass out of jail," she said with mock severity between a wreath of cigarette smoke. She bustled around the kitchen, preparing a celebratory dinner for him. The preparations were still going on when Baby appeared on the threshold an hour later. Shug saw that his old rainmaker wore a gold Rolex on his wrist and a diamond earring in his left ear. He had put on weight. Baby hadn't come to visit Shug in prison because of the superstition that a drug dealer coming to visit would jinx his own operation, but he had paid money into Shug's commissary account. Baby tried to stuff a wad of bills into Miss Julia's hand as the pair got ready to take off. Shug abandoned the dinner she had prepared for him. She waved him off irritably. The door slammed behind them. They climbed into a Mitsubishi Eclipse, a beater car Baby used to traffic drugs, circling the horseshoe a few times before heading to City Island. The quaint streets were lined with antique stores and clabbered seafood restaurants. They went into Sammy's fish box and slid into a red leather booth. "I'm bubbling right now," Baby bragged about his flourishing drug business. "You feel me?" Shug was impatient. He'd done his time, put his life on the line, and felt Baby owed him something. Baby talked about a new pipeline he had opened in Roanoke, Virginia, where he was selling kilos for $38,000 to $40,000 each. Baby offered Shug a position, hustling and filling in as a gunman for late payers. Shug demurred. He simply wanted money and a good time after his prison stay. Baby pulled out a roll and peeled off $3,000. "Just hold that for now," he said lavishly. That's your pocket money. He caught Shug eyeing his presidential Rolex. Baby took it off his wrist and handed it to him. Shug examined the twinkling diamonds, the weight of the finely tuned mechanism. He'd never held a $25,000 watch. This is what I want right here, Shug said. You focused? Baby asked Shug. He lectured Shug on smoking weed, reminding him how it dulled him, weakened him as an enforcer. Shug yawned. He wanted a few days to catch up with old friends, to party, and to get laid. They scarfed down some shrimp before Baby dropped Shug back at his grandmother's. A few days later, Pete returned to Soundview, released on 2-week bail from prison. He had dodged the murder charge after the witness retracted her statement. Twin's sister had been asked by police to identify Rolock in a lineup. When Twin heard that she was helping the police put his friend away, he threatened to kill her. She pulled out, and the detective's murder case crumpled. Pete still faced a gun charge for the arrest at Grant's tomb. Shug detected a change in his old friend. Back in 1993, when they'd last seen each other, he was customarily brash. Today, he was solicitous and reflective. He asked if Baby was looking out for Shug, suggesting, as he often did, that Baby was exploiting him. Shug learned that sex money murder had grown in power as Pete and Pipe dealt with legal battles and incarceration. But everything crumbled when Cod was arrested behind the wheel of a speeding Camaro with $500,000 in cash on August 7, 1996, in Cleveland, Ohio, a major blow for sex money murder. Cod had set up an auto store in the city that sold high-priced rims, audio systems, and, of course, stash boxes. The shop drew all of Cleveland's drug dealers into Cod's orbit, but it also attracted law enforcement. Pete angrily told Shug that he suspected that, with the right pressure, Cod would fold and tell all. He couldn't do hard time. Pete recalled that in North Carolina, Cod had given permission for the sheriff to search the van, which had led to the seizure of the money and drugs and ultimately their arrest. Shug guessed that Pete would now have Cod killed if he could. Pete told Shug that he had turned sex money murder into a blood set. He pointed to his red Converse sneakers. He'd also developed another name for the crew, Blazin' Billy. He showed Shug the gang sign, arms folded over his chest, index and middle fingers of both hands pointing skyward like pistols. They laughed, and Shug practiced a couple of times before his attention began to drift. For a while they joked about the women of the projects, and then Pete headed out. The following day, Baby took Shug on a shopping spree at Jewman. Shug told him that Pete was blood. Baby had his own confession. He had turned Crip. All the animosities over the years had calcified into Pete and Baby choosing to be natural class enemies. Baby told Shug to keep his affiliation a secret. Baby bought Shug peli-peli leather jackets, down coats, and a small diamond earring. Afterward, they drove to Sylvia's, a Harlem soul food institution. There, Baby elaborated on his plans. "I ain't looking back no more," he said. "I'm going to be a millionaire." He was shifting his efforts from the drug game to the rap business. Baby spent his days at the mixing desk at Chung King Studios in Manhattan. He had a group, Evil Minds, and he'd been heading to L.A. and claimed something of a relationship with a model actress who had a small part on Baywatch. They drove to a parking garage at West 121st Street and Frederick Douglass Boulevard, where Baby showed off his fleet of cars. A Mercedes, a black Range Rover, a Yukon Denali, and two Honda Accords. "Yo, Shug, you take this Honda." Shug sneered ungratefully. He wanted the Range Rover. Baby tossed him the keys and the title to the Honda, and Shug climbed in. Baby showed him the stash box and handed over a cloned cell phone. "Let me know what you want to do," said Baby. Shug smiled. "I'm gonna get me some shorties and some pussy." He cranked the seat back and drove to Soundview. He ignored Baby's advice to lay off the marijuana and focus on hustling, and bought some weed and linked up with a young woman in the projects, Latoya. He bought her some sneakers, and she went to bed with him. For 2 months he lived like this, drifting around the projects, blowing money, and partying. He heard everywhere about Pete's rise to power, his bodies, and his new status as a blood. 4 days after Christmas, Baby called an urgent meeting. Shug drove with B-Love, sharing a blunt as they slowed to a halt outside 551. Baby pulled up behind them. He spilled a garbled story about being robbed for his Rolex. Shug, high from the weed, giggled.
"Yo, Shug, stop playing," Baby said. "Harlem niggas stole my shit."
Back in August, Baby and another drug dealer had gone to a party hosted by an entertainment company, Final Four Entertainment, in a Manhattan club. Baby had been showing off, buying everyone champagne. A young woman split off from a group of men and hung on his every word, transfixed by his Rolex. When Baby and his friend left the club, they were jumped in a nearby parking garage by a few of the guys who'd been with the young woman. One of the men pulled out a gun and started shooting. Someone grabbed the Rolex off Baby's wrist and snatched a gold chain from around his neck, making off with both. In the weeks following the attack, Baby had discovered that his assailants were from 140th Street, a crew led by a man called Joseph Joe Dix Coppedge. Tonight, Dix had been spotted at Jimmy's Cafe on Fordham Road. As they were talking, BMO pulled up behind Shug's car in a sky-blue 1998 Oldsmobile. He stepped out, bulked up in a large red jacket, and approached Baby with an easy familiarity. For the first time, Shug realized that BMO had taken his place as Baby's enforcer while he'd been in prison. Baby had solicited BMO to kill Dix in return for a steady supply of cocaine. For months, they'd been looking for an opportunity.
"I'ma go get the guns," declared Baby. "I'ma tell BMO to put that work in."
Shug's jealousy stung like hives. The way he saw it, he was Baby's enforcer. He'd just done a 3-year bid for Baby. The murder of Joe Dix would be an opportunity for Shug to get paid and to ingratiate himself.
"Nah, I got this, Baby," Shug said.
Baby had recently cut off BMO's cocaine supply. He had messed up a couple of consignments. This was an opportunity to win back favor. BMO pressed for the job. There was no need. Baby had made up his mind, and after all, BMO was a proven killer. Shug had yet to catch a body. Baby offered BMO $10,000 and half a brick to do the hit.
Shug exploded. "Let me do it," he shouted. "I know you and BMO do your thing, but I'm your gangster, your man, Holmes."
Baby waved him off.
"You just came home," he said. "BMO's gonna do it."
They quarreled some more before Shug stomped off to the car to smoke another blunt. Baby left briefly before returning in a black Yukon. BMO climbed in, and they sped off into the night to kill Dix. They found him standing on the corner of Cedar Avenue and West Fordham, waiting to go into a nightclub. BMO, armed with a 9mm Glock, calmly walked up and, with a single pop, ended his life. The murder was all over the TV news and the early edition newspapers. Baby flaunted his victory, driving up to Harlem and parking his Mercedes on 140th Street. He got out and leaned back against his car, throwing his hands behind his head in a show of power. On the block in Soundview, BMO bragged to Shug.
"Yo, you see my artwork?"
Shug called Baby.
"I'm ready to get paper with you now."
He'd decided to stop the partying and get involved. Baby wasn't convinced. Shug was unstable, pugnacious, and nursed a sense of entitlement. He constantly demanded money, cars, and favors. Baby wasn't sure he wanted to be around him that much anymore. He offered Shug a share of the kilo he'd promised BMO, and he handed BMO only $1,000, $9,000 less than originally agreed. It was a dangerous move, but as compensation, Baby supplied BMO with more work and gave him another car, and the debt was satisfied. Shug wanted back in and refused to be placated. They met in Soundview, where Shug ended up tossing the keys and the title of the Honda at Baby and storming away. 2 days after the murder, Shug returned to Springfield to sell the cocaine that Baby had given him. The competition had stiffened, and the block swarmed with police. Shug was arrested on New Year's Eve for distribution of cocaine. he was bussed back to prison to restart his 4 to 7 year sentence for violating probation. Shug's lawyer worked hard for his release, and he left prison in early October 1997. He returned to Soundview at a pivotal period for the neighborhood. Killing had reached its height in 1993 when Soundview had 69 murders. Toward the end of 1997, that number had been reduced by two-thirds to 22. More broadly, 1996 saw fewer than 1,000 murders across New York City. Homicide rates plunged more steeply than other crimes, a milestone not seen since the mid-1960s. Some were claiming that the war on crime in New York had been won. Many pointed to the decline of the crack epidemic, which had abated significantly. For SMM, there were still big markets, but the drug was ebbing, and many of the lower-level dealers had been taken off the street. Even Pistol Pete was no longer untouchable. He returned to court in New York, where he was convicted on the gun charge and sentenced to 2 to 6 years. With good behavior, he'd be out by 1998. But on December 16, 1996, he was served with papers at the Oneida Correctional Facility in Rome, New York, where he was doing his time. They came from a North Carolina prosecutor, Gretchen Shepherd. He had been indicted for conspiracy to distribute cocaine and committing a violent crime while in possession of a gun in relation to drug trafficking stemming from his activities in North Carolina, which, unbeknownst to him, had been investigated. The U.S. Marshals delivered him to a magistrate judge in Charlotte on January 2, 1997, where he was arraigned before trial on February 6th. Peter Rolock would face federal justice and a possible life sentence. Shug was angrier than ever now that Baby was avoiding him. He pressed Baby for money relentlessly. "Where's my paper, Jay?" he demanded indignantly. "You ain't letting me hold nothin'." When Baby gave him some, it was never enough. Shug kept coming, demanding more and more with veiled threats of violence. He defined himself by money, and when Baby resisted, bitterness gnawed at him. The lack of money hurt his pride. As he saw it, Baby was violating him by not giving him any and playing him for a fool. Eventually, Baby agreed to pay him as an escort on some drug runs to Roanoke. This time, when they counted out money, Shug, with a gun in his waistband, thought about robbing him, but didn't carry through on the urge. When he returned to Soundview, Baby avoided him again. B-Love, like a manipulative court advisor, whispered in Shug's ear.
"Nigga, he's shitting on you," he said, inciting Shug further. "How come he don't snatch you up, and yet you always running after him?"
Baby had shunned BMO, too, after the hit on Joe Dix. A corrosive paranoia spread among all three.
"Yo, is Baby trying to get you and me to go against each other?"
BMO asked Shug. He wondered whether Baby was setting them up to kill each other. A few days later, a thought crossed Shug's mind when he saw BMO.
"Baby ain't never tell you about rocking me, right, Beam?"
asked Shug circumspectly.
"Nah, he love you, Mo."
Shug had preferred to think of the kids from Soundview as being like Marines, guided by loyalty and code. He needed that structure, but what was apparent now was the self-interest, treachery, and mistrust that had always lurked beneath the surface. BMO and Shug robbed some of Baby's upcoming rappers in the nearby Sackwern houses. Shug broke a kid's jaw. The next time, they held them up at gunpoint, going into their pockets to steal their jewelry and money.
"Yo, tell Baby to call us," Shug commanded.
Pete had somehow gotten the word that Baby had become a Crip. He ordered that Baby be robbed and killed. He had never liked him, and Baby's success and importance threatened his own. Now the Crip affiliation added legitimacy to his plan. B-Love would carry out the murder. Shug was brought in and told about the robbery, but not the murder. B-Love felt that he would tell Baby. But he had no scruples when it came to money and wouldn't balk at a violent robbery, even of his old friend. They enticed Baby to the block, and Shug, armed with a pistol, jumped him almost as soon as he stepped out of his Mercedes. Baby took off running through the Soundview houses. The police arrived and chased both of them. Shug managed to escape. Baby was arrested. He had $20,000 on him, and his car had been left on the horseshoe. Under cover of darkness, Shug broke into the vehicle but was unable to locate the stash box. A few days later, Baby called Shug to threaten him, but Shug wouldn't hear it.
"You violating me. I'm out here and you ain't showing me no love."
Baby tried to be conciliatory again, offering Shug more cocaine. Shug began to see that Pete and Sex Money Murder were the true power brokers in Soundview, and that a switch in allegiance from Baby's crew would serve his long-term interests better. Besides, to Shug, Sex Money Murder was glorious, noble, and untouchable. From prison, Pete began to play on Shug's animosity toward Baby, drawing him closer into Sex Money Murder. Pete called his grandmother's house frequently, sending his uncle down to Cozy Corner to bring Shug to the phone. He told Shug that he was now automatically a Blood. Shug took it to mean that he was now officially Sex Money Murder. He truly belonged. No longer was he Baby's stooge, used and then discarded. Shug went back to Jumen and decked himself out in red clothing from head to toe. He now felt part of an organization, and he wanted to wear the uniform. He was made head of security, a broadly defined role that involved checking who came into the neighborhood, identifying threats, and then, if necessary, responding. Some even gave him a new street name, Ugly Man. He answered to Bear and then Belove, the top tier of Sex Money Murder. The neighborhood had come under some heat from the city's tactical narcotics team, whose officers had been raiding street corners on Mayor Giuliani's orders. Dealers had been driven into bodegas, where they were less exposed. Sex Money Murder moved their drug trade into Papayala's. The owner's son, enamored with the crew, stored their loaded guns behind the potato chips or in the freezer. If any gang member needed a weapon, he just had to approach the plexiglass window and ask for chapstick on Medicaid. The store clerk would get the gun, put it in a paper bag, and hand it through the window. In the summer of 1997, Pete had devised from prison a new structure for Sex Money Murder that he called the Fist. On July 26th, he mailed Rowe a detailed outline of his vision in which he conceived of the organization as an underworld superpower. In his neat, close handwriting, he said that the Fist's command structure would be based on the five families. He likely took his inspiration from stories about John Gotti. In 1985, after ordering a successful hit on Gambino boss Paul Castellano at Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan, Gotti took over his former boss's empire. Before the killing, Gotti and other disgruntled capos, along with soldier Sammy the Bull Gravano, called themselves the Fist. "The Fist will be divided into three different branches," Pete wrote, specifying it should be spelled with a lowercase t and capital F. "Each branch will be made up of five dog, bloods, strong. We will have a superior of the unit, a second in command, a head of security, advisor and counselor of all situations, and an overseer of finance. Each branch will have their own indignity. The superior unit will be called 3-0s. 301, the superior of our family. 302, second in command. 303 equals head of security. 304 equals advisor or counselor. 305 equals overseer of finance." He outlined three founding sets: 5 deuce, 4 treys, and 3-0s. The last would be headed by Pete, who crowned himself Albert Anastasia after the ruthless mafia executioner. Pipe, second in command, was Carmine Lilo Galante, the cigar-smoking head of the Bonanno crime family. "Each member of the Fist will have their own duty and must serve his or her positions thoroughly. Whenever a problem should arise in our family, it will be looked over and discussed by all members of the Fist. Once a decision is made, orders will be given, and whatever has to be done will immediately be taken care of. There will be no exceptions to this rule." The Fist would function in three tiers, with the lowest, the street hustlers, giving $25 to the captains above, who would in turn give half of all they collected to those above them, the superiors. Crucially, though, any hustler could work his way up the chain by putting in work, making money from drug sales or killing for the organization. Pete concluded with a powerful summation of his ambitions. "I hope you can see what I'm trying to prepare for our family.
Remember, we SMM are like no other set. Once we are fully organized, I will open up many doors for us, that we will have no choice but to be recognized as an underworld superpower. Our hands will be in everything. My plans for our family is on the same level as the early Dons and Godfather of the Mafia. If everyone feels as strongly as I do, once we are together, we will never be able to be broken down mentally, not physically, and definitely not financially. Do you feel me? 5-10. Lock and load like a million men marching. He signed his letter, The Pistol, and drew a cavalierish Zorro-style slash underneath. Pete began regularly sending letters that were read aloud at blood meetings behind the Soundview houses, where the crew huddled like disciples hearing the word of a new messiah. His epistles demanded that the rules he drew up, the blood codes, and his directives be followed to the letter. He ordered the establishment of a legal fund and allocated an amount of money for his mother. Shug saw that he incorporated some of the slogans from the Skelzies games they played as kids, such as, Hit a killer, be a killer, into his new blood doctrine. Now those words, no longer a childish reference to sliding tops, took on a deadly realism. At one late-night meeting, B-Love stood and read a chilling message to the figures gathered, hoodies pulled up, hanging on every word. I want the Double Mint Peter rolled. A silence descended. Pete wanted his very name to be synonymous with murder. He wanted Twin dead. He went on to explain that Twin was 999, cooperating with the police. He was a dust eater. As they dispersed, many were confused, Shug among them. Jealousy had inspired Pete's wrath. Twin had partnered with Cod when Pete was arrested in 1995. Without Pete, many assumed that Cod's force field was gone and he'd be targeted by the vultures, robbed and shaken down. But with Twin, who had a reputation just as dangerous as Pete's, Cod continued to amass a fortune. Twin had reputedly secured 100 kilos of cocaine directly from a Colombian cartel and was distributing to crews all over New York City, New Jersey, even Ohio. Without the heat Rolock brought to the operation, his constant thirst for the spotlight and his lust for murder, they were free to make money. Twin felt that he was representing sex money murder in Pete's absence, growing the organization and swelling its coffers with Cod as his partner. He was supplying B-Love, stepping into Pete's role in supplying Soundview with crack. Twin wanted to hand Pete back an organization that was stronger when he got out of prison than when he went in. After Cod's arrest in 1996, Twin got more sophisticated in laundering his proceeds. He linked up with another man from Castle Hill, Nelson Rios, who drove around the neighborhood in a blue BMW Z3 convertible and convinced Twin that he'd been to Harvard Business School. He used the alias Nelson Ramirez on credit cards and a fake driver's license to open numerous bank accounts to launder money. He incorporated SMMC Inc., Sex Money Murder Crew Inc., in October 1997, with a registered address of 2264 at Powell Avenue in the Bronx. With the official company documents, Rios opened an account with State Bank of Long Island and issued sex money murder soldiers biweekly paychecks that would show parole officers, for example, that they were legitimately employed. Twin was building a drug empire that was a bona fide American corporation, something Rolock could only have dreamed of when he founded the organization. Despite all this, those close to Pete and Twin saw that Twin retained his modesty, a mark of his upbringing in the Castle Hill projects, in contrast to Pete's more privileged background. He still drove his white Toyota Camry, refusing to get a grander car like other dealers. He gave drugs on consignment to those in need and asked for no recognition for doing so. Pete wanted to be known for every act of generosity, spreading crumbs around to create a sense of obligation among his followers. Twin treated Cod as an equal partner, whereas Pete had exploited him. Twin's goodwill allowed him to broaden his operation, and his reputation as a gunbuster and a savvy businessman was starting to eclipse Pete's. Pete, impotent behind bars and stressed from the pressure of his cases, began to feel the streets had forgotten him. All he ever heard from Soundview was news of Twin's meteoric rise, Twin's sophistication, Twin's reputation on the street, which was beginning